I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are chef, writer, and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi and his longtime collaborator and pastry chef Helen Goh. They're joined in conversation by Peter Stein. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Yotam Ottolenghi, Helen Goh, and Peter Stein.
This is Yotam Ottolenghi's second visit to the JCCSF. As you all know, he is a food writer, a chef owner of the Ottolenghi Delis and Nopi in restaurant in London. He writes a weekly column in The Guardian and is a frequent contributor to The New York Times. He has published 5 best-selling cookbooks, including Plenty, Plenty More, Jerusalem, and Ottolenghi, as well as Nopi, co-authored with Ramel Scully. He is here to celebrate what will become another bestseller, Sweet, with his co-author Helen Goh. Helen Goh was born in Malaysia, but began her cooking career in Australia at Donovan's, a well-known restaurant in Melbourne. She moved to London and joined Ottolenghi, where she has been lead product developer for more than 10 years. She draws widely on Western, Asian, and Middle Eastern influences in her cooking and baking. Yotam and Helen are joined in conversation tonight by one of our favorite interviewers, Peter Stein, Peabody and Emmy Award-winning documentarian. So please join me in welcoming Yotam Ottolenghi, Helen Goh, and Peter Stein to Canbar Hall.
Welcome.
What is?
Well, welcome. By the way, that's Helen.
Hi.
And this is Yotam, and welcome back, Yotam. In fact, you and I last met almost exactly 3 years ago. On this very stage, and you hinted at that time that your next project just may be a dessert or a sweets book. So what took you so long?
You know, it's such a good book, it takes a long time to make. Helen and I have been... Actually, what led to this book is about more than a decade of hard work eating cake. And I describe in the introduction to the book the whole process of us meeting mostly on Sundays and Helen bringing over a bunch of cakes and then sitting and discussing and talking. And it does take a lot of hard work to decide what you want to show the world and what cakes you like and what works perfectly. So we worked about more than 10 years creating new cakes, and then the last 2-3 years just working on this book in a kind of concentrated way.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I've had the advantage of being able to enjoy some of the delights of it over the last couple of weeks. I tasked my partner with baking furiously out of the book as part of the research.
It's terrible.
He's very dedicated.
So when we got together last time, we had a chance to investigate a bit of your path to becoming a cook. But it's our first time getting to meet you, Helen. First of all, congratulations. This is also your first book.
Yes, it is.
Your first book tour.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start by asking you what has been your path to this very unusual and particular career of developing, especially dessert and pastry.
This is the question that I find the hardest to answer, actually, because I've come to it such a circuitous route. I actually graduated in psychology, and when I left university, I worked for a pharmaceutical company.
Yes, there are those recipes in the book, by the way.
And there is vitamin C in one of the
cakes. There's vitamin C in one of the cakes, that's right. You will see it. And part of my job at the time was to talk to doctors about new products. And one of the things I caught on to was this idea that if I provided lunch for them or catered lunch for them, that they were more receptive to listening or hearing me talk about the drugs. And I noticed after a while, not so long into it, that actually I was more interested in the lunch than the drugs. And I would then begin to spend a long time sort of preparing the menu and crafting the lunch event. And eventually I thought, well, stuff that, the drugs, and I'll just focus on the lunch. And I actually went to the caterer who used to cater for these lunches and applied for a job. And they laughed at me. They gave me a try. It lasted one day. But I think it gave me the confidence, actually, that I knew I had a lot to learn, but it was really what I wanted to do.
And that said, pastry and dessert is a special part of any kind of cook's life. And when did the light bulb go on that you, at least for this book, if not generally, wanted to specialize?
You know, I think I loved cooking of all kinds. I mean, I grew up in a Chinese, sort of food-obsessed Chinese family.
And you grew up in Malaysia or in Australia?
Well, I spent 10 years of my life in Malaysia, but I moved to Australia at 10. And I think when you're a migrant family like that, you spend a lot of time trying to sort of get that comfort from food. And so our lives constellated around that. But I think for me, when I started cooking, fairly late, having done a degree in psychology, I was fairly insecure about it. I loved it, but I wasn't sure that I was good enough. And I think one of the things that drew me to baking was this idea that there were guidelines, there were sort of instructions. And I thought, well, I can read, I can follow instructions, and I learned it that way. So, yeah.
It's so interesting because, Yotam, you too had an academic beginning. You were on a chart, on a track, really, to follow at least one of your parents into an academic career. And it was actually a pastry internship, I guess, in the UK that changed your life. And so now you're finding yourself back in the world of flour and sugar. And what was it about that experience, that first experience that hooked you?
It's a bit like what Helen says. There is something very predictable in the best possible way about a baking recipe, a cake recipe. It's very detailed. You know exactly what you're aiming for and what you're doing. It's much more difficult to stuff up, really, because if you follow the recipe, the size of the tin is clear, then the temperature of the oven is clear, the amount of time it's going to take to bake the cake, and then you're feeling you're in a safe territory. And I think for someone who joins a kitchen, this is one of the most kind of predictable, I guess is the right word, the most easy ways into a kitchen. And I felt that way. So when I was studying in London, when I learned how to cook, I went in the evening to this restaurant that I thought I have to go to a Michelin star restaurant, of course, because that's where you learn.
That's where you
things.
Begin.
Now, to be clear, you were going as a patron to eat, or you were.
No, I never ate there. But I went to the chef and I said to him, "Well, look, I'd love to work here in the evenings." And he said, "Well, go. Well, you know, that's fine. Go speak to the pastry chef because that's what they do. They go. They dump them you on someone else." And she said, "Well, that's fine. You can whip up the egg whites during service for the souffles because you can't do that in advance. I mean, that's the one thing you cannot prepare." So she put me in a corner and she said, "Well, every time I've got a souffle on order, you whip up the egg whites." And that's what I did for about 2 months. I just whipped up egg whites for souffles. And it was, I can honestly say that I'm an expert in that bit of the kitchen. But ironically, or not ironically, I ended up whipping way more egg whites later when we opened Ottolenghi and we started, you know, putting meringues in our windows, and it has become almost like the symbol of the of the Ottolenghi window. Those big piles of meringue, really kind of fist-sized meringues with either with chocolate or cinnamon or raspberry, and they're visually very effective, and really they've become kind of synonymous to the Ottolenghi shops.
And that's just you in the back whipping all the whipping all
not anymore.
So it's really you collaborated with your business partner Sammy on
the Jerusalem Cookbook. So you have an experience working to develop recipes together with others, and your whole approach is a collaborative one. And nonetheless, because as you both say, baking is kind of precise, I want to know, what does a collaboration between the two of you look like when you're coming up with the recipe?
It's quite easy to describe, isn't it, I think?
Is it? Well, we're always talking about food, and so the line of demarcation between sort of conversation about children or about the business and about the analysis of the cake is sort of all in one ball.
Yeah.
But I think we were quite disciplined when it came to the making of the book. We had to be, because there's always all the other stuff going on apart from the book. The running of the restaurants.
But is it sort of like music and lyrics, like which comes first? Would you come up and say, I think this is going to be good, and you would taste and revise, or vice versa?
We had a procedure. Normally Helen would... Helen works from home, and she would test a cake or a biscuit or a dessert, whatever it is in the book that she was doing for the first time. And many of the recipes are actually Ottolenghi products, but things that have been on our counter for years, about 50% of the recipes in the book. But it's one thing to cook it in a restaurant or in a deli, and it's another thing to make it at home. So Helen, even those recipes had to kind of go to the beginning, to the basics, and try them in her home kitchen. And once she'd been satisfied with what she'd made, she would send it over to me. And I have a test kitchen where I try all my recipes, and I would try it there. And by the time that had been tried a second time in the test kitchen, Helen would come and we would sit around and say, okay, does that work? And what does it do? And whether we love it. And love is a very strong word, but it is really almost about that, because every one of the cakes or sweets that we have in the book, we have to love it.
Yeah, it's almost a visceral sense that, this really hits the spot. This really makes sense.
And can you take an example of one of the recipes? Maybe it's a galette or a cake or something where you knew you were close, but you weren't there, and how you figured out what needed to happen next.
Every time it's a different thing. I think every cake has a different story. So, for instance, some cakes or some sweets are easy to kind of be happy with quite early on. So you kind of try it one or two or three times, and you say, okay, well, that works, and then you're happy, and then you can put it to the side.
Each one had such a different story.
There's a good the marble cakes, which
the marble
are,
cake. I mean, we
took a long time, didn't they?
Well, they took a long time, which is surprising in one sense, because the base recipe comes from Rose Levy Berenbaum, whose cake bibles we love, and she talks about she says it took her 7 years to perfect this cake, and we thought, well, why would we not build on that? I mean, we see recipes as a kind of conversation. I guess perhaps it's from our academic tradition, where there's no shame in, if you have a thesis, there's no shame in sort of looking at who has had something to say about that previously. You extract from that, you put your little bit to it, and you put it back into this sort of repository where other people can sort of join in the conversation. So Rose had this cake where she...
Describe a marble cake. What distinguishes it from something else?
Well, a marble cake is basically colours that are swirled together. And we started with the pound cake, Rose's perfect pound cake. And we wanted to add what we called sort of Ottolenghi flavours, which in this particular case was coffee and cardamom. And although it seems simple enough...
do we need a break? Do we need a moment?
And then there was this kind of sort of weeks of discussion about whether we use espresso coffee. Does everybody at home have a coffee machine? Well, no. So perhaps we use instant coffee.
Which is so interesting, because I looked at that recipe and it called for instant coffee crystals.
Right.
And I thought, if only they had asked for ground coffee, I could have that. But in fact, coffee crystals are now maybe a specialty product.
It depends who you're asking. And I think these are these kind of dilemmas that we constantly have. What do people have at home? What do they expect? Yeah. And how does it work?
And then you have to dissolve the coffee.
Coffee seems completely innocuous, but coffee isn't, because how could you measure the intensity of an espresso? One cup of espresso is very different from another. This is why coffee granules are much easier to work with in a big baking recipe because you know how much water that's you added right. to how much coffee. Yeah. So all these considerations come into play when you test the recipe, but it takes time. This is why we're going into 5, 6, 7 trials with this cake,
yes.
and we're still not getting it right.
No,
right?
I mean, then I would submit it what I think would a recipe that works really well, and then the tester would say, well, I can't be bothered to ground the cardamom. And I would say, well, if you really want the best flavor, you grind the cardamom. And she would say, well, if you really want people to make this cake, don't ask them to ground the cardamom. So there's a sort of a kind of ongoing conversation, and then we somehow come to a truce of some kind. Usually, Yotam is a diplomat, so usually it involves him.
Oh, so I was going to say, do you ever bump up against each other's insistence on one way of doing things?
I think Helen is right in the sense that there are more than just us two of us involved in the process. So we have I have a little team in the test kitchen trying recipes, and then we have the outside testers, which is the people that once we're completely happy with the recipe, we send it out to someone who tests it at home. And that particular woman has got the history of working with Ottolenghi recipes. She knows what to expect and how I want the feedback to come back. And then you can have a conversation once you've got it back. And when there is a clash or when it doesn't quite work out, then you do need to be. I am the diplomatic one. I'm the one who tries to find the middle ground when things are not quite clear as to what's the way forward.
I'm the prima donna that says yeah. no. I want this in it.
Is there a recipe or more than one where you kind of put your foot down and said no, Yotam, it has to be this way?
Often. I think yeah, it happens. Look,
well, I've lost one battle.
Which one?
Which was the carrot cake.
Oh, the carrot cake. Yeah.
So yes, I.
So there's no carrot cake in the book.
There's no. Oh, you lost no, the battle. That you we, won.
I lost the battle completely.
No,
but I won it in another way
because in a way we don't have a carrot cake because we couldn't agree.
Well, your Tom's idea of a carrot cake is sort of light. I think it's called a Swiss carrot cake. It has nut meal. It has folded egg whites. It's sort of
it's fluffy.
Fluffy.
Okay.
And my idea of carrot cake is dense and fruity, and never the twain shall meet. But
this
so
is why we have a parsnip cake and a beetroot cake.
We have a parsnip cake. We both agree that it's great, and so we solved the dilemma there.
Okay. But, of course, the other option would have been to provide both recipes, or perhaps yeah. it's a chance for book number two.
Yeah, well, that's
maybe,
what we're thinking.
Yes.
Yeah, you're reading our mind.
So I want to come back to something you said, Helen, about building on other people's recipes, because there's such a primacy placed nowadays in the food world on originality and uniqueness
yeah.
and every chef kind of wanting to have an absolute signature. And in some ways, you, Yotam, have built an amazing reputation for having something that really is a twist. It's an Ottolenghi twist. And yet you're very clear in the book when you're building on, as you mentioned, let's say Rose Levy Barenbaum's recipes. One of the wonderful dishes that I got to enjoy at the behest of Brian, who's out there in the audience somewhere, thank you so much for making this incredible fruit galette, which has a cream cheese pastry, which I'd never heard of. And you're very clear in the head note or somewhere saying, we built on Rose Levy Barenbaum's cream cheese pastry dough. That's like the beginning. And I thought that was both generous and brave and also unusual in the world of most creative arts where people want to say, this is mine and you will never be able to.
Well, I think originality for originality's sake is dangerous. You know, it leads you to create things because you want to put a mark or be famous or whatever. And I think we prioritize satisfaction, fulfillment over eating, or something good, enjoyment over originality. But by our nature, or more particularly Yotam's nature, is to kind of push the envelope a little bit. And Yotam is a bit irreverent, probably because he doesn't have this sense of tradition in cakes. I'm much more, he's bolder, let's say. So I like to start with a recipe that I know works, it's technically sound. That's very important to me. And I will take it to Yotam, and usually he will make a few suggestions, and sometimes he will infuriate me, but 9 times out of 10, it will be what makes it, what we call, it Ottolenghicizes it. And
wait, you have to repeat that verb. What is it? Ottolenghicize.
Ottolenghicize.
Okay. Or Ottolenghify.
Ottolenghify. Oh, yeah, that's probably a little easier to say. And I don't think he means to do that, but I think his nature is just to want a little surprise. And I find that with my work, I'm constantly straddling this line between the exotic and the familiar, because you don't want something so exotic. People want comfort with food, but they...
Especially with cakes.
With cakes, because there's a whole culture and tradition and grandmother's cakes and all of that. But we also want a little surprise.
You're listening to chef, writer, and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi and his longtime collaborator and pastry chef Helen Goh. Their new cookbook is Sweet, Desserts from London's Ottolenghi. They're joined in conversation by Peter Stein on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You love surprises.
Yeah, I think it's always been the case that I wanted to create some kind of... a surprise, I guess, is the best description of it. Something that is a bit unfamiliar in the process. It doesn't need to completely alienate you. Of course, it has to be within the range of things that we love to eat and give us comfort. But a bit of something surprising, where there is spice that you wouldn't quite expect in this particular context, or something about the texture, or something about the structure of the dish. And I think with baking, you could do this, but you do it on the periphery. I think with, you know, we were talking about core recipes, and then you mentioned the galette. I mean, that is a really, really great recipe for pastry.
It takes a lot of work to make it. Can you describe what a galette is?
A galette is like a free-form tart or pie, more.
So
you take your pastry, your dough, and you roll it out, and you fill it up normally with fruit, but there's other variations. And then you fold it back in the middle. So it's a pie without the dish. And essentially, this particular recipe that has cream cheese in it, and it's quite a kind of a lengthy process in the sense that you need to rest it properly and do it in a few stages, really yields a wonderful pie or galette crust. But so you can, of course, experiment with pastry, and we do constantly experiment, but actually... It's about the filling, it's about the context, it's about how you serve it and what shape you give it. There's a lot of things you do around the periphery that really make it original. And you don't need to start... I mean, a pound cake is a pound cake. It's equal amounts of sugar, eggs, and flour, and sugar and flour. But when you want to be original, you look at the others, at the things that adorn it, at the garnishes. Right.
But going back to the galette, I mean, the pastry is great, and that's Rose's recipe. But what we also did was to have this idea of sprinkling some ground almonds on the bottom before the fruit is laid on top.
And not just almonds, I have to say. I mean, the recipe,
amaretti.
I was going to say, amaretti cookies, which are this intense hit of almonds.
Exactly.
And that's the thing that kind of
Well, that serves two purposes, because it does have that flavor hit, but it also absorbs the liquid as the fruit is baking. So it seems like a small touch, but for me, it makes the difference between... I mean, it's a great base, but we build on that. Yeah. And I think that is a worthwhile addition.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
I can attest firsthand. In addition to this notion of building originality on the great work of other sort of core foundational recipes, there's this tension I find in baking between precision and spontaneity. Mm. And I'm wondering if you could, either of you really could talk about that, because this is you're involved in the creative endeavor, and yet you have to be absolutely rigorous with.
And I think that we worked really hard to find, in every recipe in the book, what was the non-negotiable, what was it that needed to be done, the kind of precision for it to be a successful bake. And then we give little notes, like if you don't have blueberries, use this. If you don't have ground almonds, do that.
You don't want to do the icing, you want to just have the cake naked, it's also fine. I mean, I think often what puts some people off with baking is the stuff that goes after the cake is baked. You know, the whole stuff that involves a palette knife and involves spreading things on top of it. And often it's absolutely fine. It shouldn't put you off baking if you don't like the work that goes after the actual process. So like Helen said, we wanted to make sure that people find their own way into bakes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just, there isn't just one way, there's various ways. And variations are always much easier for people to appreciate or to fathom because you could personalize it a bit. And I think the act of personalizing is great, but it's just deciding when you can personalize.
Yes.
You can't just decide to put reduce the number of eggs by half. It's not going to rise. You know,
see,
it's not going to happen.
That's the way I bake, and it does not work. Are there particular recipes in the book that you can point to that are more appropriate for the improvisatory, spontaneous?
I mean, for you,
for me,
for
yes.
You. Well, maybe not if you go to half eggs, but what we do love, well, one of the cakes that we've been sort of demonstrating during our book tour is what we call a rolled pavlova. And it's what we love about that. We see
I love how a pavlova is getting applause here in the house, right?
We see it as a blank canvas. So in the book, it's with peaches and blackberries. But it's been quite autumnal in London the last few weeks, and we've switched it to plums, and we've added some cinnamon and a sort of sprinkling of almonds. So it's this idea that you can choose the fruit that you like, choose the sort of look that you like. If you like a more tropical flavor, you might have mango in it, but maybe grate some lime zest or have some sort of more tropical flavoring or even ginger in the cream. And so that's where you can play around with it. But we give you the basics so that you can play around.
And so how important do you feel is technique and mastery of technique? I just came off of making a documentary with Jacques Pepin, who mm-hmm. calls cooking the art of adjustment. And at the same time, he's very, very clear that technique is not something that's really optional. You will always need to use it, and you will always need to get better. And I think oftentimes people are maybe scared of baking because it seems to require more technique or technical mastery because of the hand precision. And I'd love to hear that either argued with, disabused,
yeah,
dismissed.
I think it just depends on your definition of technique. So technique is everything. Even just whisking eggs is technique. And there are just recipes that are more technically challenging and other that are less. And we really try to create a whole range of recipes in the book to cater for different people's levels of how comfortable they are with particular techniques. So at the end of the book, there is a section called confectionery, where in many of the recipes you need to cook sugar to a certain temperature and you use a sugar thermometer. It's not rocket science, but it's something that you need to feel quite comfortable to do. But the beginning of the book starts with biscuits and cookies. Those are technically, I think, quite simple to do. So, of course, you need to master a certain technique, but the level of expertise on how much you want to push yourself is completely up to you. And I think the most delicious things often are the simplest ones. There is a lemon and poppy seed cake that Helen always quotes as one of her favorites in the book. It really, technically, it doesn't require you anything, really. I mean, you melt your butter and you mix it up with the eggs, and there isn't really much whisking going on. So sometimes you need to decide how much you're going to, cream your butter and sugar before you add the eggs. But this one is literally just mixing everything together, pouring into a tin and baking. And it's one of the most satisfying cakes. So
I think I see technique as the sort of line drawing before you paint or before you, go on to sort of do other forms of art. It's the basis. And then you can really enjoy it. So, I mean, I find if you reading a recipe and kind of getting a kind of a roadmap of what you're doing and understanding whether it's a creaming technique or a beating technique, instantly you sort of have a path to what you're doing. And then you can actually enjoy the process rather than thinking, oh, gosh, what am I doing next? And sort of tearing around the kitchen,
right.
So
you mentioned earlier about the idea that desserts or cakes in particular are there to give comfort and people don't want to necessarily encounter things that are quote-unquote exotic. But, exotic depends on what your own background or experience is.
Yes, true.
And I noticed that you, for example, Helen, incorporated a number of very interesting flavor profiles from your experience living and growing up in a Malaysian or Malaysian Chinese family.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about how that works in a what is mainly a kind of Western dessert
yeah.
book.
Sure. I mean, the recipe that comes to mind when you say that is the pineapple tarts. And the Chinese culture, Chinese New Year, it's sort of like the mince pie. I don't know if Americans have that tradition.
Oh, yes.
Mince pie, right.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So it's the sort of Chinese equivalent of mince pie. And it has it's flavored with cloves, star anise, and pandan leaves, usually.
What are pandan leaves?
Pandan leaves, it's like a blade of grass, and we call it the vanilla of the East. It's what, in a lot of Asian cooking, that is the flavor. It's subtle, but it's, you know, you it just lends a certain sort of aroma to it. But on the other hand, so in the book we say, you know, traditionally it's made with pandan and we give the recipe with pandan. But we also say if you don't have it or if you don't want to look for it, you can substitute a vanilla bean. Mm. So it doesn't make or break it. It, you know, we like to think that we're giving something of the best of its kind, but actually it's not a disaster if it isn't in there.
And has some of Helen's East Asian or Southeast Asian influences helped you? I mean, have you learned to expand your own flavor profile, which is already very adventuresome?
Helen has been teaching me a lot of things over the years. They're not all involved, and they don't all involve sugar. So, if one of her great contributions is she actually taught me how to love tofu, because I started off really not liking tofu, because I had really bad experience and bad treatments of tofu. I think before I discovered it, the only times I've tried tofu was in certain health food shops, being really dull and bland and gray and not in all sorts of stewy stuff. And traveling with Helen in Malaysia, I've seen it being prepared properly. I've even been shown how to make it and then fried, marinated and fried and given the crust that you want to give it. And I mean, it's a whole art form to cook and enjoy tofu. So I learned that from Helen and through a few other Malaysian friends that we share. And with baking, of course, pandan is a really, really great way to infuse flavor, but also, you know, using things like pineapple and things that are very particular to Malaysian culture. And you're right to point out that this book, although it does feature flavors from my Middle Eastern background, from Helen's Southeast Asian background, it is really quite rooted in Western baking traditions, you know, in European, Australian, North American baking traditions. Whenever we brought our flavors in, it was just as a flavor rather than as a technique. There's no baklava recipe or steamed
Malaysian cakes.
No babka.
No babka in this one, no. We leave that for... Well, there was one in Jerusalem, but yeah.
Right. The baking, at least right now in the U.S., is still a huge thing that people do in families, with families. Are there family-friendly things that you can point to in the book, or things that are good for kids to kind of jump in on?
There's a lot. I mean, in a sense, when we worked on the book, we tried to create this almost, I call it curate, maybe it sounds a bit presumptuous, but it is kind of getting everything to work together in a certain way. So there's the grown-up recipes, and they would have coffee and alcohol, and they were quite complicated, flavor complex. And there's things that are much simpler. And I think it's with kids, it's the simpler palate that you want to satisfy. It's not so much about they can eat anything really, but there is a certain level of simplicity that kids enjoy. So in the biscuit or cookie section, you know, we just try those spéculoos cookies, which are slightly spiced almond topped with almond cookies. They're really good for children, or the shortbread cookies, or certain cakes like we talked about, Rose's marble cake or pound cake. There is one kiddie-friendly one that's got a bit of. And normally we don't use coloring, but in this recipe we have a bit of pink coloring, so it's got marbled. So it's like a Neapolitan flavor combination of chocolate, vanilla, and red, whatever that is. strawberry, but there's no strawberry there, obviously, swirled together. So it's those kind of cakes that really yield themselves to either cooking with kids or mostly just feeding them, because when you cook with kids, normally it's a complete mess.
Disaster.
You get nothing done.
The idea
really
is usually better than the reality. But I also like to deconstruct some recipes. So my sons absolutely love crepes. You know, they will eat it for breakfast every morning if they could. And we have a recipe, it's a blintz, really. But I wouldn't go the whole hog by, you know, doing the cream cheese and roasting figs for them, but I would give them with, you know, a slick of Nutella on it. And there's a Knickerbocker Glory, which you can make for a dinner party, which is amazing. It's a ice cream layered with fruit and cream and caramelized nuts. But I wouldn't do that for them, but I might make the ice cream when I have lovely raspberries, and they love that. So, you don't have to do the whole thing. You can find bits that you like and deconstruct it that way.
So you both live in the country that has given us the Great British Bake Off, or the Great British Baking Show, which, as we all know, was like the highest rated show of any kind,
really?
On the BBC.
Is that right?
Yes, and was very, very, very popular here.
Wow.
It's really quite extraordinary. Wow. Do you have any thoughts on whether that show has helped, you know, popularize baking, or whether it's made everything now sort of everyone feels they need to be a professional, you know, decorator or icer, because it's also really popular here, and
yeah.
it's a very lovely, comforting, sweet show in these times.
Yes.
It has a really nice outcome every week.
Yes.
It's a great show also in the landscapes of shows, not only politics, because it's, you know, TV shows have turned very competitive, and although this is a competition, it's a very nice competition.
It is. Yeah.
It's very collaborative. You can watch it with children, and there's no chance that anyone will be kind of hurt or go to bed crying for any kind of reason. And it has really popularized baking in the UK to a degree that we haven't really seen. So I always say that I'm quite surprised when you go to you kind of the average British supermarket at the moment, the baking section is really remarkably well stocked. You know, you've got the glucose syrup, and you've got all the icings, and you've got all the levels of chocolate and nuts, etc., and even the baking tins and the equipment. So all of a sudden, the baking section has really ballooned in supermarkets, and it's a great thing to see, because I mean, baking is such a wonderful thing. It's such a great tradition. It's something that goes back a long time. It's where families get together. It's really the most special way of creating a family activity together. And it's nice to see that it's being done. It's really the most harmless way of spending time together, isn't it, baking a cake? So it's rather special.
Except maybe when there's fights going on in the kitchen. Is it possible for you two to actually literally bake side by side, or is that really something that needs to be done separately?
We've done a bit of that recently, because we've had a few sort of demos and little video shoots. And
how's that gone?
It's boring, but we get along remarkably well. I'd like to throw in a little tantrum here and there, but I find working with your Tom is like sort of choreography. We anticipate each other. It's quite harmonious. Now I feel really nervous saying that. I'm going to
jinx it. What's going to go wrong next time? Something will.
You've developed this extraordinary world, mainly in the UK, with your shops and restaurant, and of course the publishing and the books, the articles. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked when I've come back from London, said I've eaten one of your restaurants, or people say, oh, does he have a restaurant in the States? So I'm sure
it's good you're asking that, because we're going to have questions from the audience. This is normally the number one or two questions.
Yes.
This comes up.
We'll get it out of the way now. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a question of will you. It's more of a question of how big can a chef's or creative person's empire be before you start to feel that it's really not yours anymore?
Yeah.
It's a real It's a dilemma, a conundrum that we're constantly discussing. I mean, I'm the face of the company, but it's a partnership, really. There's Sammy, Noam, and Cornelia. We're four core partners running the company together. And that has helped us expand, because each one has an area of responsibility. But we've only expanded in London so far. And it's, but we have been talking over the years of how we could, if possibly, maybe open a restaurant in another part of the world. And so far we haven't found the formula, because I think it is a formula. It's in a restaurant, anyone who's worked in the food industry knows that in every food outlet in the world, something goes wrong every day. Some things haven't been, delivered, the fridge broke down, someone's fallen ill, someone's had a fight, the croissants, the humidity is too high, so the croissants are not proving properly, etc., etc. And you need to deal with all these things all the time, otherwise the standards start to slip. And to deal with that, you need to have a system, and our system is not very efficient. We just go and deal with it, and it's and it's very difficult to do when you're far removed from the thing. So we're still asking ourselves whether it will ever be possible. I mean, years go by, and we still haven't opened a restaurant in America, but who knows, maybe one day.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features chef, writer, and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi and his longtime collaborator and pastry chef Helen Goh. Their new cookbook is Sweet, Desserts from London's Ottolenghi. They're joined in conversation by Peter Stein. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And Helen, have you ever been tempted to do the restaurant, that actually be on the production line?
I was foolish enough when I had no experience to open my own cafe. and it was the best and the worst thing I've ever done.
This was in Melbourne?
This was in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. So when I left the pharmaceutical company and was rejected by the catering company, I thought, well, I'll have to... actually, it was a longer story. My partner at the time had... what you call a redundancy package. He was able to sort of leave work for a sort of lump sum of cash, and he said, you know, if you had this sum of money, what would you do? And I said, I would open a cafe, of course. And so we opened a cafe. He had no experience either, but we worked our butt off. And I guess my cakes were singled out as being kind of special.
Kind of special.
And well, we had a journalist come.
How did that happen? I mean,
Who noticed it? I just put my head down and just sort of really tried to learn and really tried to perfect the cakes. And one day, a journalist who was a food writer, actually, he had come in to taste an array of cakes. And I didn't really, I think I was too busy and too sort of frazzled to sort of take much notice of it. But I remember one Sunday, the store was closed on Sunday and Monday, and I remember one Sunday sitting across on a bench looking at my store, and I lived above the store at the time, with my head in my hands thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get up and work tomorrow. I'm so tired. And this man, he had a murder mystery bookstore down the road. He comes running out and waves this paper at me. And there's my face in the front of the paper. It was a Sunday paper. And with this title, World's Best Chocolate Cake, with my little face on it. I thought, gosh. And I never slept after that, because... It was a very small cafe. I would make cakes round the clock, you know, sort of six in the oven, set the alarm. And it's a cake that takes quite a long time to cook. It's in the book. I would put them in the oven, set the timer for an hour and a half, take a nap, come back down another. So, you know, this went on. And then I decided, actually, this couldn't continue. So we sold the business. And that was when I decided, you know, it was great, but I really want proper training. So I then went to train properly after that. So I sort of did it the wrong way around, in a way.
But the cake and the passion for that particular chocolate cake, that has persisted. The version that you have in the book is, they're small, right? Is that the chocolate cake we're talking about?
No, we have a few chocolate cakes in the book. The one we have is a kind of medium size. Okay. It's called a take-home chocolate cake.
Take-home chocolate cake.
And that was the one that Helen mentioned.
What do you think it was that got it that moniker of world's best?
I think at the time when it was, there was a lot about sort of chocolate fudge cakes. It's neither fudgy nor is it spongy. It's somewhere in the middle. And I think also it's very easy to make. All of those factors.
It's easy, but it takes a while. You say it takes a
while. Well, the cooking takes a while, but it's literally you make it in one bowl. You don't need a machine. It all goes into one bowl. The thing is waiting for it to cook. It takes quite a long time.
So as long as we're talking about chocolate, I wanted to ask you to defend probably the only food stuff that I don't like. And that is white chocolate.
I don't think you're on your own with that.
Why is it even called chocolate? It's basically like Crisco with vanilla.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's true.
And yet you have white chocolate recipes mm-hmm. in the book. So I don't mean to be facetious. I really do want to know. What am I missing?
You know, I had exactly the same sentiment with that. And when we started collating the recipes for the book, I hadn't eaten, I must admit, the whole of all our cakes. There were certain cakes that I just had an antipathy towards, and our white chocolate cheesecake was one of them. I just thought white chocolate cheesecake, it was just sort of felt really cloying to me. But I know that it was a popular cake that our customers loved, and I had to test it for the book. And when I tested it, I thought, this is amazing. I loved it. Because actually, there's no sugar in it. The white chocolate sort of contributes that sort of mellow sweetness. And then you've got the slightly salty cream cheese. So that kind of converted me.
I would never eat a bar of white chocolate, but I think in the context that Helen describes it, it really does work with cream. For instance, when you make a white chocolate ganache and then fall through whipped cream, it does create something quite special that you can't get just with sugar, because it gives it the stability of a ganache, you know, like a proper chocolate ganache,
yes.
and the richness.
Yes.
And you really, like Helen said, you don't need to add sugar because it's so sweet. And it's pretty special. There is a recipe in the book for a celebration cake which has a white chocolate ganache.
Yes.
And in that context, if you tried it, you might be converted yourself.
Actually, there's one other, Peter, and I think if there was one thing that might convert you, it's there's an oat and cranberry biscuit, which on its own, it's actually really very satisfying. But then if you put a coat of white chocolate in it, it becomes really special, and even I love that. You've got that sort of sharp hit of the cranberries, and then you've got that chocolate that just makes it all sort of luxurious, and it's really lovely.
You're going to try?
Brian, are you listening? Brian is going to try. I will report back next time you visit.
Exactly.
Well, I think on that note, and there may be some white chocolate defenders in the house. I didn't mean to single it out. And maybe there are varieties of white chocolate that I'm not. Maybe there's actually quality grades that I haven't discovered yet. I don't know. But on that note, it would be great to start hearing some of your questions about recipes, about baking. And Yotam and Helen are here to take your questions. So
I'm Indian, and I use a lot of spices in my cooking, as you do in yours. And I was wondering, what is your favorite spice and why?
This is such a difficult question, because spices are really, really need a context, right? Like, so for in cakes, if you look at this book, you'd find spices that keep on appearing in various recipes. So we use star anise, or we use cardamom, or vanilla, if you want to call it a spice, or cinnamon. There's or allspice. There's spices that really lend themselves really nicely to savory.
In fact,
sweet
we have a
cooking.
Cake that's called spice cake.
And we've got the spice cake,
which has a lot of spices.
A lot, yeah.
One gravity. Obviously, everyone has a flavor profile. You've become famous for, in some ways, geographically shifting ever eastward. And as I was thinking when you came here last time, you'd become very famous for Mediterranean spices and flavor profiles. And you were then, at that point, really exploring and embracing Iranian and Indian.
True.
And now, perhaps with Helen's influence, turning ever eastward.
And even with Scully, who's been my co-author on the previous book, on the Nopi Cookbook, who's also comes from that background. It's been very much a process of discovering the spices. And I think spices are actually I find it more illuminating to look at them as in groups rather as individuals. So you can find cumin in India, and you can find cumin in the Middle East and in North Africa, but they do very different things with cumin. And I really think it's very instructive to look at them as a group. You know, often in Indian cooking, I mean, you probably know much more than I do. Cumin is associated. You know, with cardamom, with chili, with turmeric, with coriander, asafoetida. You know, a bunch of spices. So I kind of see those spices as a group, and they really kind of symbol. So when I think Indian cooking, I've got that kind of in my mind, rather than singular ones, because singular spices are they travel very easily between cultures. I think it's the groups that identify cultures.
Yeah. It's how you combine them.
Yeah.
Hi, I've been really inspired by a lot of your flavor combinations, and I wonder, from either one of you, what have you been surprised by yourselves? The ingredients, not so much spices, but putting two things together.
I know one from this particular book, because there is this chocolate pudding that you did with a lime.
Oh, with a lime.
Yeah,
yes.
And I never thought that chocolate and lime works so well together. I'm actually not such a big fan of mixing chocolate with fruit. There are a lot of exceptions, but generally I much prefer to mix chocolate with other things than fruit. And this particular dessert, Helen introduced to me, and I knew at the beginning that she's going to that it's got chocolate and lime, and I thought that just doesn't do it for me. But I've been completely happily surprised to be proven that it's just actually one of the best dessert in this book. It's a really, really rich, beautiful. You can eat it warm or at room temperature, with a bit of cream. It's a pudding. It's a baked chocolate dessert, and it's got a bit of lime, and it just works really wonderfully.
Where did that idea come from?
I'll tell you where it came from. I was reading a novel. I don't remember what it was.
That's how it works in Helen's world.
Once I get a food idea, the novel goes out, and I'm just with this idea. And someone was asking about an old-fashioned chocolate bar, which I don't even remember the name. I've never eaten this chocolate bar, but it had lime in it. And why was it phased out? And I also have this thing. I don't like, for example, I don't like strawberries and chocolate. Yeah. So Yotam and I share that. Yeah. But I was intrigued by this person's sort of fanaticism for this confection. And I thought, well, I'll try it. I mean, it was once upon a time out there, so someone had the idea. So the pudding was a recipe I had in my repertoire that I loved. And I know that if I go to Yotam with something, it's always better just to have a little something up your sleeve. And that was the lime was the something up my sleeve. Yeah,
wow.
Inspired by that.
So, Yotam, I understand that you were on the vanguard of creating the movement of modern Israeli cuisine, and then Helen, I know that you have a background in Western, especially Australian patisserie. So I'm wondering if this book seeks to create an Israeli type of patisserie, which I don't think currently exists, and I'm also wondering if your backgrounds clashed at all.
I was going to say, you should be sitting here.
Yeah. It's definitely not an Israeli patisserie reinvented or reimagined. Because, I mean, if I'm completely honest, I haven't lived in Israel for about 20 years. And there's a lot of things going on with Israeli baking, and I'm aware of it, and I read about it, and I go and experience it when I go. But we've been wandering in all sorts of directions. You know, some of them would have kind of bits of the Middle East popping up in here and there, or some of them have Asian recipes. But most of them are really quite international in scope. You know, they could find their place in various, you know, environments. So I wouldn't say that it's kind of rediscovering Israeli cooking, but there isn't really any conflict. I don't think there is inherent conflict in recipes. You know, it's just what you choose to project onto them, and we worked really well together. So all in all, peace between Israel and Australia, and everything is going really well.
You do have those semolina, the soaked semolina cakes that are...
The rose water cake, yeah.
Yeah, that's very Israeli.
Book,
yeah,
very there Israeli,
is. Yeah, yeah. Like I say, there is a bits and pieces of various things. And I think this is part of the joy of what Helen was talking about, of kind of using recipes that I've kind of... from various backgrounds and playing up with them. So there would be some of those.
And he's snuck tahini in a few things.
There is tahini, yeah. Yeah, there is tahini in a few recipes.
Hi, so I was wondering, I know there's so many recipes in this book, but I was wondering what would be the recipe or two recipes you recommend we make, because there are so many and we do not have time to make all of them. So, is there something, especially I'm part Middle Eastern with Middle Eastern ties, that you would recommend we make, and why?
Yeah, well, with Middle Eastern ties, I guess yes. The recipes that have tahini in them are I quite like. So there is actually I can think of two. One of them is the brownie, and it really is quite a traditional brownie recipe. All you Americans would know what that tastes like. But we added chunks of halva and swirls of tahini in it. It's really, really good. and that's what it is. I mean, it's a great thing to start with, because it features those flavors nicely. And then there is a bar. We call it Middle Eastern Millionaire's Shortbread, and it's got a nice layer of shortbread, and then halva, it's topped with caramel. It's made with tahini, so you make a sugar caramel, and then you pour a tahini paste inside, and we top it with some salt. So it's got salt, caramel, tahini, and halva in it, and it's just to die for.
And Helen, if what dish of your own creation would you be most happy to find that your partner or loving friend or kid had made for you when you walked in after a hard book tour?
I mean, having talked about all these flavors and spices, the cake that I return to over and over again is the lemon poppy seed cake. I mean, we've affectionately called it National Trust cake, because it's sort of, you know, it's a simple cake, the kind that you would find in a lot of cafes. I think ours is a very good version, if I can say that. But it's simple. I like a little sweet something with my cup of tea. I mean, I won't eat a whole cake, but just a sort of tiny little slice of this with a cup of tea is very satisfying. And I love lemons, and the poppy seed just gives it a slight sort of textural hit. It's the sort of cake I could eat every day, and would probably eat every day if I could.
And is what makes it an Ottolenghi recipe?
Good question.
That's not a very Ottolenghi recipe. No.
In fact, we don't sell it.
So perversely, you've chosen the least Ottolenghi cake.
Well, I'm often stuck by this idea that, and I don't want to be verbose or sort of pretentious in this, but you know, you see these fashion shows. Alexander McQueen or whoever it is. Oh no, he's dead, isn't he?
Yes,
sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway,
his label still exists.
Yeah. You know, they're flamboyant things. They come out the runway, and then the designer comes out, and they're in jeans and a t-shirt. That's my go-to. You know, that's what I love.
So we have the little black slate, the little black plate,
black dress.
We've got Alexander McQueen.
Alexander McQueen and the lemon poppy seed cake. Clearly crossing all kinds of boundaries here. Helen Goh and Yotam Ottolenghi, thank you for your wonderful recipes.
Thank you so much.
And your great presence here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was chef, writer, and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi and his longtime collaborator and pastry chef Helen Goh. Their new cookbook is Sweet, Desserts from London's Ottolenghi. They were joined in conversation by Peter Stein. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.